Hi, I'm Armin Alney, host of To the Point, produced at the nonprofit public radio station KCRW. We're going to start this podcast in just a few seconds. First, though, I just want to ask you for a little support, because in order to be comprehensive, we have to talk to people all over the world. That's expensive. We have six producers, and they work very hard. That adds to what we need to do in order to try to meet your expectations. So we've made it easy to help. You can donate $10 by texting KCRW to 20222. Do that if you will. Let's now start the show, and thanks.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Online learning, past, present, and future. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. 2 years ago at Stanford, a massive open online course, or MOOC, attracted 160,000 students. MOOCs looked like the future of higher education. The internet would make college available to millions. Now going without it, traditional college professors began to fear for their jobs. New research shows that MOOCs have not lived up to their promise, with very few students completing their courses. But with millions invested, online learning is not going away. We'll hear how it's changing. Today's talking point, the latest mystery from North Korea, why a sudden high-level execution has taken place. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney back with To the Point. Massive open online courses, or MOOCs, held the promise of higher education for millions who can't now afford it. But despite big investment from Stanford, Harvard, MIT, and Silicon Valley, MOOCs have not lived up to their billing. We'll hear about new ways of using the internet to meet the worldwide demand for focused learning. Today's talking point, North Korea's new young leader has executed his uncle by marriage, his former mentor, now denounced as a traitor and human scum. We'll talk with an expert on the Hermit Kingdom. First, this news update. The White House today says it's not considering amnesty for the fugitive leaker Edward Snowden, despite comments last night on 60 Minutes by the NSA's top official in charge of assessing the damage of Snowden's revelations. Here is Richard Ledgett.
So my personal view is, yes, it's worth having a conversation about. I would need assurances that the remainder of the data could be secured, and my bar for those assurances would be very high. It would be more than just an assertion on his part.
Richard Ledgett talking to Richard Miller of CBS News. Again, the White House today, there will be no amnesty for Edward Snowden. Josh Meyer is a former terrorism correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He's now a professor of journalism at the Medill School of Journalism in Washington. Good to have you on our program. Josh Meyer, are you there?
Yeah, Warren, I'm here.
Good. How do you think it was, or how do you reconcile this? The Guardian newspaper is also reporting that the NSA would like to have Snowden back and would be willing to consider amnesty because, as he put it to, as Ledgett put it to on CBS, he has the keys to the kingdom.
Yeah, you know, when I heard that last night, I thought it was rather extraordinary that they would be floating this. But one thing that's interesting, Warren, is that even though he was criminally charged in June, that there has not been an indictment of Snowden. So that does make me wonder if there is any possibility here for something like that. My personal view is I'm wondering if Ledgett, had his words mixed up just a tiny bit, and when he meant amnesty, that he might have meant sort of a partial amnesty, that they would be willing to have a conversation with Snowden in which he would come back, be prosecuted, perhaps do a plea agreement, and then provide the information. I don't think that there's any possibility, and I'm surprised that they would consider any possibility of giving him complete amnesty given what he's done. I mean, it's rather extraordinary what he's done. He took 1.7 million documents from the NSA, and as Ledgett said last night on 60 Minutes, some of these things are extremely damaging to the national security of the United States. We're talking about an exhaustive list of the requirements that show what the gaps are between what the U.S. knows about China, what it knows about Russia, what it knows about Iran, what it does know about these countries and what our vulnerabilities are. So I don't think that there's any realistic possibility of amnesty for him.
Well, certainly, even if you listen to what we just heard from Leggett, it would be a conditional
right.
deal. And when we heard from the White House, actually the spokesperson was Caitlin Hayden, who's a spokesperson for the National Security Council. He said that he's accused of leaking classified information. He faces felony charges here in the United States. But as you indicate, no indictment yet.
Right. I mean, that might just be sort of a due process type thing. But I know that they're investigating this very, you know, very aggressively. But yeah, I can't imagine the White House doing that. I mean, you're talking about a Justice Department that threw the book essentially at Bradley Manning, an Army private, for you know, disclosing information that was by orders of magnitude less damaging to the national security than the kind of stuff that Snowden has. So they would have a hard time reconciling any kind of amnesty for him, I think.
Richard Leggett is rumored to be a possible next choice as the head of the NSA. Do you think this will hurt his chances?
Well, I think he might be the number two guy there, replacing John Inglis. I don't know if he's been rumored to be the top guy, but whatever the case, you know, that's a good question, Warren. I don't know about that, but I think that, you know, the one thing that is clear is that the NSA really has to figure out what Snowden has, what he's released, and how damaging it could be to the United States. I mean, the most extraordinary part about all of this is that everybody seems to be in agreement that Snowden has only or the journalists that he's given the documents to have only disclosed less than 1% of what he has. So, you know, as somebody who's covered this for 14 years or so, I really wonder what else is out there that's coming, and I'm sure that the NSA does too.
Well, you just said, though, that he has 1.7 million documents. They reveal these gaps in what we know about other countries and so on. Don't we know what he took?
No, and that's all of this is extraordinary. That's the one thing to me that's the most amazing thing is because of the special situation out there in Hawaii where Snowden was, the NSA facility, they didn't have the kind of backstops in place and the safeguards in place to actually figure out where he was, what he was downloading. He also downloaded some of the documents under other people's names and passwords, so they literally do not know what he has. I mean, there was a good New York Times story about this the other day in which they said that a lot of times the NSA finds out what's missing when reporters call them and ask them for comment about it, and that is extremely embarrassing and damaging to the United States when this affects, you know, our allies around the world. I mean, you know, when Germany finds out that we're spying on, you know, the chancellor, and they hear about it from a newspaper reporter, that's not the way to run a, you know, a spy shop.
Okay, well, back to Snowden, with the White House saying there will be no amnesty for Edward Snowden.
Right.
They can't back away from that, one would assume. Josh Meyer, it's always good to hear from you, and thanks a lot for being with us today.
My pleasure, Warren. Thanks.
Again, with the Medill School of Journalism, his latest book, co-author, The Hunt for KSM, Inside the Pursuit and Takedown of the Real 9/11 Mastermind, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. In a moment, online learning, past, present, and future, done to the point.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. Quote, just 2 years ago, a Stanford professor drew 160,000 students from around the world to a free online course on artificial intelligence, starting what was widely viewed as a revolution in higher education. That's according to Tamar Lewin of the New York Times. But she reports also that early results for such large-scale courses are disappointing. Tamar Lewin joins us. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
What was the expectation, and why was it disappointed?
Well, there's a kind of euphoria when this first happened at this idea. I mean, there's always been distance learning. There were those old sunrise semesters on television and little matchbook, you know, correspondence courses and then lecture capture in lots of universities. But this seemed like a whole brand new thing that anyone around the world with an internet connection could see these, like, the very top professors in the world, and there were built-in quizzes. And it just seemed to open and really democratize higher education for everybody. So there was this, oh my goodness, this could be completely different all over the world. Everyone could get a top flight education.
What's happened?
Well, people who have internet connections indeed can get these amazing lectures and quizzes, but it's not easy, and it's no easier than anything else, and most people who do it don't follow through. And that 160,000 number, it turns out enrolling is so easy. There's no barrier. There's no penalty. There's no cost. You just enter your email and you're in. So that's not really like committing in any way. So, you know, a good half of the people who sign up don't ever even look at the first, you know, lecture. And I've done this myself. I thought, oh, that looks cool. And then I sign up and I think, oh, no, you know, more math than I can manage. So it's still amazing. There are these remarkable stories of the kid in Mongolia who gets himself to MIT at, you know, a very young age because he did so well in an electronics course, or the little girl in Pakistan. But as a mass movement, it's not going to be replacing universities.
Not anytime soon, at least. Again, Tamar Lewin is a higher education reporter with the New York Times. Laura Perna is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Graduate School of Education, co-author of a recently released study called The Life Cycle of a Million MOOC Users. Laura Perna, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
What did you find?
So our study looked at the pattern of movement of users through the 16 Coursera courses that were offered by Penn faculty during the first year. So this, we looked at the first generation of courses offered at Penn, and we found many of the things that Tamar just mentioned. So high numbers of individuals are touching these courses. Only about half are viewing the first lecture. And persistence rates, as measured in our study, are low. So only it ranges across courses, but depending on the measure of persistence and the course, the percentage of folks who are there at the last course section ranges from 2% to 14%.
That's still a lot of people if, in fact, you have 160,000 signing up.
That's right. So these percentages are low, but they translate into a reasonable, you know, much higher number of folks than could be touched in a traditional type of course when you multiply them out. And I think that's important to remember. You know, these are, we're, in our study, we apply a traditional measure of persistence, but these are not really traditional courses.
Let me go back to Tamar Lewin. What about Udacity, the company started at Stanford University?
Well, there's really been three big MOOC companies, and Udacity kind of came first because it was founded by Sebastian Thrun, the Stanford professor who did that artificial intelligence course, and it's a for-profit company. He got very involved this year in deciding that he knew the way, and Jerry Brown backed it, that they could really make a difference in helping California disadvantaged kids get prepared for college.
So Jerry Brown, the governor of California.
Yeah. They started a partnership with San Jose State with three very small pilot classes to see, and Sebastian Thrun hired a bunch of mentors is what they called them, but they were really kind of like tutors who would be available online 24/7 to help kids. And the hope was maybe that would be a way to get everybody through remedial math or in this course, or everybody through the first algebra course. But the results of the first round were just dismal. And then then they got put on pause. But it turned out that over the summer when they did the second round, they made some adjustments and the rates were a little better. And it's really unclear whether this is going forward or not. But meanwhile, the San Jose State faculty, not the ones who used the courses who liked them, but the other ones have sort of risen up in revolt and said, we don't want to use MOOCs. We think it demeans us and turns us into teaching assistants if we use a kind of blended thing where we use someone else's lectures and we're just there to kind of help kids in the classroom. And, you know, we hate the whole thing. So that was a big development this year.
Laura Perna, back to you at Penn. With the original idea was that this would be spread all over the world. We heard about the kid in Mongolia, the girl in Pakistan. Has that turned out to be the audience that signs up for these classes?
So from the data from our study, we can see that there are users from across the globe. About a third of the users are from the U.S., and most of the users are from westernized nations. We have a small number of folks who are from Africa, but really most of the users are in the U.S. and the U.K., some of the traditional types of venues.
Did it turn out that a lot of them already had degrees, even though the promise was that degrees would be available to people who never otherwise would have had a chance?
A survey that was done by my colleague at Penn, Zeke Emanuel, his data show that most of the users of these courses do have degrees. It's important to remember that the courses we looked at, though, are really targeted towards folks who have degrees. And I think that's an important part of this discussion that we need to be considering. So when we say MOOCs, that many people think of just one model, but there's a whole range of different courses and course offerings within that, and a whole host of different goals of the instructors, of the institutions, and of the folks who are signing up for them.
Let me introduce Robert Liu, a faculty director at the Bach Center for Teaching and Learning at Harvard, also a faculty director of HarvardX, which partners in online education with MIT through EdX. Lots of different abbreviations used here. Professor Liu, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Tell us what's going on at Harvard.
Well, so I think what we're trying to do at Harvard is to really redefine the conversation in terms of, you know, what do we mean by a meaningful learning experience and what can we do online and how we can blend that effectively, you know, with what happens on campus. I think just hearing the conversation now, what's quite clear to me is that the bulk of the world continues to think of online learning as, if you will, the online version of the most traditional form of a course. Even the fact that we still primarily talk about courses and MOOCs, in my view, is really limiting what the possibility might be. So, for example, at HarvardX, what we have now realized is that sort of a modularization of the content to smaller modules not only gives you enormously greater flexibility in terms of how they might be used on the Harvard campus, how they might be used elsewhere, but also opens up enormous flexibility for a wider range of users in terms of how they might like to learn from this material. So in terms of what we're seeing now, so much, I think, has been focused on taking, you know, the most traditional conception of a course in terms of its length, in terms of how it's captured as far as lecture and a few interspersed assessments might be concerned, and placing that online, when really the research shows that there is enormous headroom, you know, in terms of possible improvements in learning that we could achieve with technology. And that's what I think HarvardX is really trying to focus on, is a more transformative step in terms of how we think about online learning and its combination with what we do, you know, with students in person.
You have said that you're already, or we are already, all of us are already in a post-MOOC era. What do you mean by that?
So if you really think about it, how we consider a quote-unquote course, it tends to be a rather fixed model in terms of the content, in terms of a specific sequence, and in terms of timing. Timing, which I think largely, if we roll back in history, is very much based on the timing of harvest, for example. To try and apply that to the online environment ultimately makes no sense. And what we're increasingly seeing is that students, learners come to the platform with very specific needs, needs that I think might be better met by a more, if you will, curated approach to how the content is configured. So in other words, the longstanding tradition is that for a given class, one size does fit all. That ultimately, here's the course, 10 students take it, 30 students take it, 300 students take it, and by and large, they must all fit somehow. Once again, going back to this notion of a greater degree of modularization of content, our hope is that we'll be able to customize the learning experience based on student background, based on their aspirations, based on their needs, much more effectively. Where if we have smaller modules of content, what a faculty member can really do is, in fact, curate the particular learning experience for that student that is really what they need and what is most appropriate for them. So the term MOOC, I think if C stood for content, it would be fantastic. I think course is far too limiting right now.
Okay, and tell us what a SPOC is.
So a SPOC is a small private online course where, in effect, what we're seeing is that all of this digital content is not just for extremely large-scale, wide-open kinds of audiences, but it's also an opportunity for you to build sort of smaller online experiences that are very tailored to a specific audience. So, for example, if you think about the needs of, for example, healthcare workers in a specific country, one could imagine building a Spark that is very much tailored to them. And that's not so much the customization of a specific course. It might, in fact, involve the combination of materials that, you know, for example, in the case of HarvardX, might be drawn from basic science, from the medical school, from the School of Public Health, from the law school, that will allow us to really come up with a SPOC, a learning experience that is optimized for a very specific audience. Ultimately, one of the benefits of the digital sort of opportunities that we have is enormous flexibility, which is something we haven't had before. And so I think it's time we really leverage it.
So back to Laura Perna at University of Pennsylvania. You've done some studies on MOOCs. What about SPOCs? Have you had an opportunity to look into them and see whether people are signing up, and if so, if they're completing the courses and getting something out of them?
We have not looked at that in our research. We haven't had the access to data on that. But I think these ideas are quite promising, and I think we have important issues that we're trying to face in higher education with regard to finance, access, affordability. And so I think the types of innovative approaches that are being mentioned really do have some potential here.
And Tamar Lewin with the New York Times, do you find that there are others besides Harvard that are trying these more flexible models to use for internet learning?
Oh, yeah. A lot of people are going in that direction. There, you know, whatever the specific data right now, I don't think there's any question that this opens up a lot. And students love that they can, you know, listen to the modular lecture as many times as they want, and they can go at their own pace. And particularly Coursera is working, and edX as well, with lots of universities to try to find ways to blend in their materials with what's already going on campus. It's being used in job training. It's being used at consulates around the world. It's being used now with the World Bank. And there's just enormous potential, even if it's not, you know, going to be, and here's how you'll get your first math course. It is, here's how you're going to get a lot of learning. And even if it's people who already have degrees, it can be a fabulous way to learn something new and really expand your horizons, or to get a different kind of job.
Robert Liu, quickly, how does online learning fit into the campus experience?
Well, so one thing we have discovered is, and actually it's fairly obvious to, I think, most that have spent a lot of time thinking about higher education, is that this term, the flipped classroom, which is used so often these days, is really just another way of phrasing how to really implement active learning in the classroom. So that ultimately, it's an opportunity for you to rethink what you do with your students in person. So we have a commitment that the online experience is not meant to be substitutional for what happens on campus, that in fact, the idea is that it's like a transformative resource for what you do with your students. So that in some ways, we almost view it as being able to have our cake and eat it too, in that in terms of an online student, an online learner, our hope is to give them the best possible learning experience that they can have online. But for students on campus, all of that digital material represents a tremendous resource to completely activate what happens in the classroom. And by active learning, I don't mean this notion of, well, you look at videos outside of the classroom, and then you meet with your instructor and you chat about things. There's a very long history of a variety of modes of active engagement based around problem solving, based around comparison, based around case study analysis that can really be driven by the ability of getting some material covered in the digital space,
okay,
outside of the classroom.
All right. Hold those thoughts. We're going to take a very brief break. And when we will be back, we'll continue this conversation. Later on our talking point, the latest mystery from North Korea. Why a sudden high-level execution? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
This This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
Well, we're only back with To The Point, talking today about massive open online courses, or MOOCs. Professor Robert Liu of Harvard says he would rather have them called massive open online content in order to emphasize that we're really not talking about traditional courses at all, but something much more flexible than that. Coursera has been mentioned by a couple of our guests. That's a for-profit MOOC company founded by two Stanford professors. Julia Stiglitz is head of business development and strategic partnerships at Coursera. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
What do you have to say to what we've heard about the way in which this is changing? The evolution has been pretty fast. We're talking about something that's happened over the past 2 years.
Yep. So similar to what Robert said, I think what we're seeing is that students are coming to take MOOCs for all different reasons and have very different intentions than a traditional student in a college setting. So when we look at our students and we ask them what your intention is for signing up for a course, you see very different completion rates based on their intention. So students who say that they intend on completing it, it's actually about a 64% completion rate relative to the 4% that was in the Penn study.
Our listener named Maggie has sent us an online message saying that she, who is near retirement age, has taken MOOCs, found them tremendously fulfilling, took two of them. She watches lectures, participates in discussion groups, but she never intended to take the exams because she has a full-time job. So, Julia Stiglitz, you're talking about a very different person there than the traditional college student, 17, 18, 21 years old.
Very much so. I mean, we see students who watch every single video but don't do any of the assignments, or students that engage in all the social activities. They participate in forums. They are active in Google Hangouts and on our Facebook page, but they're not interested in doing the assignment. And I think our challenge will be thinking about how we create a platform that's flexible enough to meet this diverse set of learners who do have very different intentions.
Have you figured out a way to make money?
So the revenue stream that we've rolled out so far is something called Signature Track, and this is where we authenticate someone's identity. So we take a picture of them, record their keystroke biometrics to make sure that they are them, and then at the end of the course, if they successfully complete it, they get a verified certificate that's co-branded with us and the partnering institution. And for a lot of students who are interested in putting the MOOC completion on their resume, they want this additional layer of authentication in order to show employers.
So this is something different from college credit, I take it, this certificate that you would get from Coursera, or would the partnering institution, in fact, give credit?
It's not for credit, but many of our students aren't interested in credit. They want to show their skills. They want to demonstrate them. They want something that's going to help them move in their career. What they're looking for is not credit.
Let me introduce Jonathan Reese. He's a professor of history at Colorado State University. He's author of Refrigeration Nation. In his Twitter bio, he now calls himself the self-appointed scourge of MOOCs everywhere. Professor Reese, good to have you with us.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Are you a self-appointed scourge, even of the kind of flexible, massive open online content that we've been talking about with our last couple of guests?
Well, that depends. If you market that content directly to professors and the professors really have an open option whether to use it or not, then I think it's great that they have something else that they can use. My fear is that not on MOOC-producing campuses like Harvard or MIT, but on MOOC-consuming campuses like state schools and community colleges, that this kind of resource, which requires an expensive contract, will lead to pressure from administrations on faculty to adopt MOOCs that they might not do so otherwise.
Would this lead, then, to a change, as we heard suggested earlier, in the function of a professor, a teacher of philosophy, for example?
Indeed. If you don't really... I went to graduate school in part to get lots of content knowledge about American history. If I farm out that content knowledge to somebody else, then a huge function of my expertise has suddenly become useless. And my fear would be that people without tenure would be replaced in the future by people with less money, who make less money and won't be as qualified to teach the material.
So it might be used then to cut the budget.
Yeah, we've already seen examples of that in a few places.
Where?
The San Jose State example, for one.
I was going Okay, what happened there?
Well, if you look at the relationship between the English department and the philosophy department, the resources that would have gone to the philosophy department to teach a particular course on justice are being redirected over to the English department, where the English department are the ones who'd be teaching that course. And my fear is that if the students go with them, then there won't be any resources left for philosophy. It's certainly the fear that the philosophy professors who wrote a really terrific open letter to the person teaching that MOOC, Michael Sandel, that came out earlier this year in April.
And how did Michael Sandel respond?
He responded exactly the way you would have wanted him to respond, which is, I really don't think anybody should be losing their job just because I'm teaching a MOOC. But at the same time, didn't really put his money where his mouth was. That MOOC is still going on.
Let me go back to Tamar Lewin of the New York Times, who first told us about the situation at San Jose State and the interest of Governor Jerry Brown, who certainly does want to cut the budget where possible and has done so before at the University of California. We're talking about San Jose State, one of the state universities. Did this appear to be an effort to cut the faculty?
I don't know that it was an effort to cut the faculty, but I don't think there'd be any argument that it was an effort to serve more students at a lower cost by expanding what a faculty member could do by giving them extra materials. They are still, I should say, while it's unclear what's going to happen with the Udacity pilot, they are working with edX and have had great results with a blended class where students did much, much better, and that's spreading to a bunch of other Cal State campuses. So nobody's lost their job because of that, but it has been a way to get students through this difficult required course better, faster, without having to retake it.
So, Jonathan Reese, back to you, our self-appointed scourge of MOOCs. Does that sound like a way of coping with the issue and satisfying you as well as Governor Jerry Brown?
Well, I think the most important thing is that the faculty involved have a choice whether to use a MOOC or not. If you can build a better mousetrap and convince faculty that this is the way to go, then they should absolutely have that option. Instead, most of the MOOC providers market directly to administrations, bringing them into an area of teaching where most of them have shown little interest beforehand.
Robert Liu, back to you. What about that? Is that your model for marketing, or do you want the faculty to have a choice at places that don't originate the MOOCs, but to get them from you?
We feel very strongly that faculty should have a choice. I mean, I think there's no question that this sort of wonderful material could be misused, but once again, not to harp on this sort of endlessly, I do think this notion of a course is indeed the wrong grain size, and that if you think about it, how do you actually adopt sort of a whole entire course for use? That really limits what you're able to do with it, which is in part why we are so interested in making it much more flexible and modularized, so that ultimately it's the equivalent of using a chapter from someone's textbook. That way, I think it gives faculty far more freedom, far more flexibility, and ultimately it's not as much of a threat in terms of what might happen or what perhaps leadership that might not realize what the consequences might actually do. There is one thing I would like to comment on as well, is this notion that having this digital content, even if we use the term the flipped classroom, will replace the faculty member in the classroom. If anyone has flipped a classroom with any kind of efficacy, what you will realize very quickly is that, in fact, it's much more challenging to flip the classroom than it is to lecture. That ultimately you need expertise to be able to guide the discussion, deal with the comparisons, follow up the questions which might come from all sorts of angles on the topic sort of at hand. So in my view, faculty are more necessary than ever for the flipped classroom versus less necessary.
Jonathan Reese, how do you respond to that?
My personal concern as a historian is that a flipped classroom will take the place of reading. I guess I flip my classroom already. I assign reading and I talk about it with my students during class. Most of the MOOCs that I have come in contact with are more humanities related, and none of them have a single required book. I just think that's a terrible way to go about educating people, certainly in the humanities. Might work for other disciplines, but certainly not mine.
Maybe they just aren't very good.
That could be the case. And there are probably some places where watching videos instead of reading would be acceptable. But I would hope that most faculty in the United States have better standards than that.
Julia Stiglitz, is there business for Coursera in designing courses as of the sort that Robert Liu has talked about? Do you see yourself potentially or see Coursera as competing with some of the universities?
No. So I don't see ourselves as competing with the universities. I think how MOOCs are going to play themselves out in institutions is going to look different in the U.S. than it does in some emerging markets. So in the U.S., I think it's really going to be about supporting professors, creating a more active learning environment in their classroom. So flipping their classroom and using the content, the MOOC content outside of their classroom to have more engaging discussions and debates within the classroom. When we look at emerging markets, I think there's an opportunity to fill some of the human capital holes, and that's where I think MOOCs can play a role in providing access to content in countries where they might not have a professor that teaches that content.
Back to our listener, Maggie, who said she's taken a couple of courses and never intended actually to complete them because she has a full-time job, but she just wanted to get involved. Can you, Julia Stiglitz, elaborate a bit on the kind of things that might be available to people like that might not resemble courses as traditionally taught at universities?
The types of courses or the types of activities?
Yeah.
There's a huge range of courses on our platform. So there's about 540 courses at this point. There's everything from introduction to songwriting, from Berklee School of Music to classes on various computer science courses to a class on modern poetry from University of Pennsylvania that's just a fabulous class. There's a huge range in topics.
Does the course in modern poetry have the potential, though, for removing faculty members who and might administrators assign it rather than giving it to professors or assign it along with teaching assistants?
I don't think so. I mean, if you think about who your favorite professor was and what made that person your favorite professor, that's not going to be replaced by one of these courses at this point. I think there is a potential, though, that another professor could use that content to help enhance their classroom experience.
So, Jonathan Rees, you wouldn't object to a MOOC on songwriting or computer science, would you?
Well, if I could keep a firewall between all those users who are doing it for enjoyment and higher education, I would have no objection to MOOCs whatsoever. The problem is that it's the universities is where the money is, and my fear is that these for-profit companies, or very close to for-profit companies, are simply going to take resources away from face-to-face classes on campuses. A lot of campuses all over America are already hurting.
So, Professor Liu at Harvard, you said you don't want to see that happen. You're very concerned that it not. But how do you enforce that? How do you make sure that it doesn't go that direction?
Well, I think one thing we're really committed to is this notion of dialogue, because ultimately we must remember that this is moving incredibly quickly, that we're looking at something that has unfolded over roughly 2 years. And so, for example, we're at the moment, at this particular moment, hosting a number of faculty dialogues that will also include faculty from a wide range of other schools as well on exactly this issue. Because ultimately, HarvardX and edX is committed, you know, to the notion that this is a transformative kind of opportunity for institutions, not sort of a destructive kind of opportunity. So that's something that I think we really need to talk about. And I welcome the conversation. And I would also say that we are seeing the very first generation of what folks are still calling MOOCs, unfortunately. But I think that moving forward, we will increasingly see things that are significantly different and will allow us to really understand how a variety of modes of learning can be supported by this with a variety of aspirations.
Back to Laura Perna. We haven't heard from you for a while at University of Pennsylvania Graduate School of Education. You've done studies indicating that the classes that were shorter and had fewer reading and homework assignments did, in fact, attract more students. Might that lead to a kind of pressure on professors in order to reduce the content and assignments to keep more students on board?
So our finding was that persistence rates, as again as traditionally defined, were somewhat higher for courses that had fewer workload demands on students. But again, you know, I think it's important to remember that these are the first generation of courses that we looked at. I think another important point to consider is that MOOCs are, what we're seeing here is an innovation, and we're at a time in higher education where we do need some innovation. We have really important needs for our society to have greater skills. Our workforce needs greater skills in order to be competitive. Young adults need certain types of education and training, and we have a need for delivering additional skills and content to older adults as well. At the same time, we have the increasing costs of higher education, and we have stagnant college completion rates. So we have a lot of problems that need to be addressed within higher education. The way we're conceiving of MOOCs right now is of one particular beginning attempt at this. I think there's a lot more to be learned about how this new innovation may or maybe not create some improvement in these real important needs that we have.
And Tamar Lewin, back to you. Final question. Higher education reporter for the New York Times, you said that or reported that pretty much every university and college is looking into MOOCs.
Yeah, I think there is something irresistible there. And it may not be a MOOC, it may be a SPOC. There's also the MOOS. There's many, many new acronyms here. But we are at a point in history, as Laura said, there are a lot of issues to be solved. And you'd be hard pressed now, I think, to really defend why every single, I don't know, Psych 1 professor in the United States should be writing his or her own lectures rather than getting some really great ones and sharing them. And there's just a lot of potential there, and it's hard to argue with that.
Okay. That's all the time we have. Tamar Lewin, higher education reporter for the New York Times. Laura Perna at the University of Pennsylvania, her study, The Life Cycle of a Million MOOC Users. Robert Liu, faculty director at the Bach Center at Harvard, also working with HarvardX at MIT through edX as well. Julia Stiglitz at Coursera, for-profit MOOC company founded by two Stanford professors, and Jonathan Reese at Colorado State University, author of Refrigeration Nation, calling himself the self-appointed scourge of MOOCs everywhere. Good to have all of you on our program. Thanks a lot for joining us today. Last week's sudden execution of North Korea's second most powerful official has led to conflicting interpretations. Is the 30-year-old leader, Kim Jong-un, showing who's really in charge or revealing that he's really weak? What are the consequences for other top cadres for relations with China and with the U.S.? Back in a moment with To the Point.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
Well, we're not only back with today's talking point. Jong Song-tak was Kim Jong-un's uncle by marriage and North Korea's closest friend of China. The public accusation that he was organizing the overthrow of the Kim dynasty includes these words: if the living of the people and service personnel further deteriorate in the future. That language has been taken by some as an unusual admission that the country's not doing all that well. Professor David Kang is director of the Korean Studies Institute at USC. Good to have you back on our program.
Happy to be here.
How do you take this? A very, very challenging situation there. Is everybody now in the higher echelons of leadership in North Korea afraid for his life?
Probably. Right. I mean, it's as you said in your teaser, it's almost impossible to tell whether this is a show of force or whether it's a show of weakness. But certainly, I think Kim Jong-un was showing that he's willing to use an extraordinary amount of force with anybody who questions him. And we'll see how long he can hold out on that.
What about this list of charges, including the idea that his uncle by marriage wanted to overthrow the dynasty in case things got worse? Does North Korea usually admit that things are bad?
Well, I think this is what's really interesting. If you get past all the extraordinary rhetoric about worse than a dog and stuff like that, it's an admission by the regime that how the economy is doing is actually very important. And what it's not clear is whether the regime thinks that they can blame Zhang for the bad economic situation and still get away with it without the without the people deciding, actually, Zhang is probably just a scapegoat. But it's pretty clear if you parse what's going on that the list of charges was pretty extraordinary because they pointed to real problems in the regime, economic growth, factionalism, you know, and for them to even admit this, I think, is pretty astounding.
Now, since the charges were lodged and Zhang was executed, Kim Jong-un has been making public appearances. He showed up at a military design institute, at a ski resort, at a fish factory, and that was highly publicized. Does that appear to be an effort to sort of reassure people that he's around and about and everything's going okay?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the way that they're portraying this is, shockingly, business as usual, and we've just rounded up someone very powerful, but you know, I'm in charge. And it seems like it was a pretty awesome show that after 2 years, we're coming up on 2 years from when his Kim Jong-un's father died and he took power. And it seems pretty clear that he's now asserting that he's actually in charge. Because for a long time, there was a lot of speculation that he, you know, we don't even know if he's 30 years old yet, that he would basically be a puppet and, you know, the older generation would continue to actually hold the reins. But what I think this is showing pretty clearly is that he intends to be the one in charge and that nobody's safe, even if you're a very senior leader.
His father, Kim Jong-il, took over from his father. How did he handle that, and how did he demonstrate that he was in charge?
Well, that's part of the charges labeled against Zhang is that he tried to orchestrate a coup d'etat in 1996 against Kim Jong-un's father, Kim Jong-il. There have been, you know, I mean, purges, executions, these are not unusual in North Korea. They've been going on since the 1950s. I mean, it's classic palace intrigue for over 50, 60 years. What is unique about this is just how publicly they humiliated Zhang, you know, putting out on all the newspapers and the TV of arresting him and dragging him out of a meeting and then executing him right away. But there have been, you know, recurrent attempts to or challenges to the power in North Korea.
He is said to have been the champion of Chinese-style economic reform and to have been the official in North Korea who was closest to China. Now, how significant is that, do you think, in his demise? Does that mean that there's no way that North Korea is, in fact, going to adopt a similar kinds of economic reform, or is this sort of accidental?
I actually think, you know, there's two reasons that he may have gotten into trouble. One is politically, that he was one of the most powerful people with cross-institutional ties, with the military, with the bureaucracy, with the party, and so he was a real threat to Kim Jong-un. The other one is that Zhang was in charge of China-North Korea economic relations, and that gave him not only political power, but access to a lot of wealth, corruption, foreign exchange, and so he was the champion of all of the trading, mining deals, and everything else going on between China and North Korea. And I think the task, or two of the questions is, the first one is, I think this is pretty clearly Kim Jong-un's attempt to gain control over all that money that's going on between China and North Korea and be able to distribute it for his own needs. And secondly, can North Korea now reassure the Chinese businessmen and investors and the Chinese government that there will be business as usual? And I think they've got a pretty steep hill to climb, but that's exactly what they're going to have to do in the coming months.
What about the army?
That's what we all want to know. I think, you know, over the last couple of years, there's been a real attempt by the regime, by Kim Jong-un and people to sort of diffuse the power of the military, because the army had increasingly become saturated into the party and the bureaucracy. And I think this is part of the struggle for Kim Jong-un to try and get power back to himself and keep the military on his side while still limiting their power. And it just shows how delicate his rule is, how much he has to pay attention to, because it's not at all clear he can do that either.
What about the nuclear program?
I think when we look at what happened with Zhang, obviously from the outside, we all wondered, what does this mean for foreign policy, or was it a message to us? I think most of this was actually internally motivated by palace politics or attempts to control corruption and money. So it's not directly about the nuclear program per se. That being said, my sense is that on the whole, we had a kerfuffle, a big incident last spring when there was a lot of tension between North Korea and the outside world. In the last 6 months or so, North Korea has sort of been trying to play more nice. They're in the nice part of the cycle. And I don't anticipate that they're going to go back to confrontation quite yet. We all expect at some point they're going to launch another missile and do another nuclear test. But my sense is that that still isn't necessarily going to happen right away.
What about relations with South Korea and the new regime there, more conservative and a little more hostile toward North Korea than the past one?
Well, in some senses, I think, again, how Kim Jong-un handles the Zhang thing is mostly domestic focused. Actually, the South Korean leader right now, Park Geun-hye, has been more open to trying to build relations with North Korea. So she's talked about building trust politique with North. They've talked about reopening the Kaesong joint economic zone between North and South Korea. That hasn't gone very well. And she's certainly not going to be engaging North Korea the way that past regimes did. But I think the South is interested in moderating the level of tension. Probably in the very short term, the North isn't going to be interested. I'm much more concerned about domestic politics. But my sense is that both North and South Korea are in the nice part of the curve, at least for the next 6 months or so, where they're both trying to play nice, at least for the time being.
Okay, a lot of questions and more questions than answers for sure, but that's always the case with North Korea. It's great to talk with you, David Kang, Professor of International Relations and Business, Director of the Korean Studies Institute at USC. Thanks again.
Thank you.
I'm Orman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.